Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Has Norman Rockwell been overlooked as an American master? In decades of work as a magazine illustrator and cover artist, Rockwell created hundreds of astonishingly detailed paintings designed unapologetically to appeal to a mass audience. Rockwell's style of visual storytelling struck many critics as outdated even at the peak of his career, as elites of the art world adamantly rejected his sentimental, if realistic, portraiture for more novel forms of expression. And yet, Rockwell's work remains very much part of our shared visual literacy in the U.S. His paintings of a family with heads bowed over Thanksgiving dinner, of a little boy about to get a shot from his pediatrician, and of young Ruby Bridges braving an angry mob to integrate her elementary school are hard to forget. Art and culture writer Deborah Solomon writes about the man who created these paintings in her new book, American Mirror, The Life and Art of Norman Rockwell. Deborah, welcome to Think.
Hello, Chris. Thank you for having me.
So you've done biographies of Jackson Pollock, of Joseph Cornell, which might make people assume that you would not take an interest in a sort of mass market artist like Norman Rockwell. Can you talk about what got you interested in him as an artist?
Yes. Well, I do come from a traditional art historical background. And I wrote one book on Jackson Pollock and another on Joseph Cornell. And during those years, I did not give any thought to Norman Rockwell, who, of course, had been written off when I was in school as a mere calendar illustrator and a painter of freckled Boy Scouts and their mutts. And it really wasn't until 2001, when I saw a show of his at the Guggenheim Museum in New York, that I realized how much richness there is to the paintings and how much had been overlooked. Traditionally, of course, abstract painting tends to be glorified as the defining style of the modern movement. And I think as a result, a lot of realist and figurative painting got overlooked. And Rockwell is part of that.
Well, anybody who assumes that they know Rockwell's life story and that they can read it based on the work he produced is likely to be very surprised by what you tell us in this book. For one thing,
yes. The highest compliment is the one I received from Laurie Moffat, who is the director of the Rockwell Museum. I didn't know how she would react to the content of the book and the fact that she embraced it and said that she feels like she never really knew him before, what came as a great relief to me.
I would never have guessed, first and foremost, that he spent his early childhood in New York City.
Right. He is a native New Yorker.
Mm-hmm. And felt pretty distant toward his family of origin.
Very much so. He did not have enormous affection for his parents or his one brother.
And interestingly, though, everything you could find seemed to demonstrate that at the very least, his parents did not discourage his interest in art and were proud of his talent in art.
That's true. His mother was the daughter of a painter. There was some artistry in his family genes, and his family recognized early on that he had a very unusual skill for draftsmanship. He drew beautifully from the time he was a little boy. And he was encouraged by his parents. So whatever differences he had with them, they were not about his work.
I love the story of his father reading bedtime stories to him, and little Norman Rockwell would sketch out his vision of the story that he was being told.
Right, especially Charles Dickens. He loved drawing Dickens characters. And Dickens, of course, was a great storyteller and a lifelong inspiration to Rockwell.
Now, as you mentioned, his maternal grandfather had worked as an artist. Things did not end well for him. Did the specter of that failure sort of hang heavy over Rockwell's decision to pursue a career as an artist?
I think so. What do you think?
Clearly.
I open the book with the story of Howard Hill, a forgotten 19th century painter. And he had about as tragic a life as an artist in America could in the 19th century. And I'm sure he did alert Rockwell to the dangers of the artistic life and may help explain why Rockwell, in turn, really never wasted a second of his life and was careful to avoid all the perils of an artistic career. Illustration, I'm sure, struck him as a much safer path than being a fine art painter.
Because illustration was a steady gig. You had your deadlines, you turned stuff in, you got your paycheck.
Exactly. It came with a paycheck.
Mm-hmm. What kind of formal art education did he have, and what kinds of exploration would he ultimately do on his own of different painting styles and different traditions?
Mm-hmm. Well, he had a classical art education. He studied at the Art Students League of New York, which is the same place that Jackson Pollock studied and any artist who was in New York studied there. And at the Art Students League, they teach you to draw from the figure, which is the foundation of all art education, basically. You have to learn the muscles and the bones and become expert at anatomy. Some artists learn that and then abandon that later in their careers, such as Jackson Pollock, of course, who did not make his reputation as a figurative painter. But Rockwell remained a figurative painter, and he loved that part of art history as well. He knew a lot about the Dutch masters and spent some time in Europe looking at the great masters of art history, and really, I think, remained a figurative painter throughout his career. He never painted a landscape. He claims he tried abstract art, but none of those works survive. Hmm. His great love was the figure.
There is one painting that he did where he sort of created a facsimile of a Jackson Pollock drip painting.
Yes, The Connoisseur, which shows an elderly connoisseur from the back looking at a Jackson Pollock drip painting. And there's been a lot of disagreement over what that painting is actually about. Some people say that the connoisseur is looking at the Pollock with disapproval. But I never felt that. To me, it's a painting about Rockwell acknowledging that a new kind of art had come along and a new generation had replaced his generation.
I was interested.
It's a painting about the passage of time, in other words, yeah. Much as many of his works are.
I was interested to read that he was a tremendous fan of Pablo Picasso.
Yeah, he really understood modernism. I mean, it wasn't for him. He didn't want to be a modernist himself. He wasn't interested in living a bohemian lifestyle, and he wasn't interested in making avant-garde art because it was important to him. He was an inherent populist. It was important to him to reach a broad audience and to appeal to the American public. But at the same time, he did have enormous respect for the American and European avant-garde and was a very well-educated man.
How did he get his start at Boy's Life magazine, of all places?
I know. The Boy Scouts had just come to America, and his first job was as art editor of Boy's Life magazine, which probably sounds loftier than it was. He earned $50 a month, which he was very glad about, but his name was not on the masthead, and his job was to illustrate the stories in the magazine and also assign other illustrators to do illustrations. And in those days, of course, Boy's Life magazine consisted mostly of adventure stories about boys who were often hiking in the Canadian woods and befriending Indians and setting off on grand adventures. So Rockwell's first field of expertise became boyish boys. Adventurous boys.
And you say this was not an early, you know, it was not his best work, but it did give him an opportunity to start to find his voice as an artist.
Yes, that's true, because he really, one of his great contributions was to move childhood onto the cover of the Saturday Evening Post. Before he came along, most illustrators were just doing pretty women. That was the main subject of his era, women doing activities that required very little movement, such as admiring a dove or admiring a flower. And that was the subject matter of most magazine covers. When Rockwell started working for the Saturday Evening Post in 1916, he began portraying scenes from everyday life.
And
which was entirely different, genre scenes of ordinary Americans going about their day-to-day lives. Of course, he invented all the scenes. He wasn't observing them. He was not a reporter. He was making them up. But in many ways, his Boy's Life work helped him explore the theme of boyhood later on for the Saturday Evening Post, which, of course, at the time was the largest circulation magazine in the country. And this was at a time when there was no TV or radio or internet, and everybody in America looked to the Saturday Evening Post for entertainment.
So tell us a little bit about what was in that magazine and what its sort of political leanings were and why at the time it sort of was an ideal outlet for Rockwell's work.
Okay. Well, it was a fairly conservative magazine. It was politically conservative. The editorial page was conservative. So it was somewhat like the Wall Street Journal today, where the editorial page gave off one message, whereas the journalists who wrote for the magazine were politically neutral or didn't show their politics. Rockwell himself was fairly apolitical. He certainly did not join the editorial side of the magazine in bashing President Roosevelt and the New Deal. He was involved with his art, and although he was registered as a Republican, he was a very moderate Republican, and later in his life became more liberal.
So how did audiences respond to Rockwell's work? It's amazing to think that he did his first cover for the Saturday Evening Post when he was like 21 or 22.
Yeah. No, people loved his work because he was such a good storyteller. Mm-hmm. And there was always something funny about his pictures. And every detail contributed to the story. So you could admire his cover on many different levels. You might think it was funny, or you might think it was beautifully painted. But I think it operated both as painting and as humor.
So the process by which he conceived of these paintings and then planned for them and then executed them is really not unbelievable in that it strains credulity, but it's amazing how hard he worked on every single scene.
Right. A lot of people think that commercial artists just do it for the money, whereas Rockwell actually lost money on his Saturday Evening Post covers and had to make money else in other ways, mainly through advertising work. But he really labored over those magazine covers, and each painting that he did for the cover is much larger than the cover itself. Each painting is large enough to hang over a fireplace.
Was there so an... excuse me for interrupting. Go ahead.
No, but he was doing full-size canvases that would be shrunk down into magazine covers. And that was unusual. It allowed him to put more detail into the canvas if he worked on a larger scale, but it also created a lot of work for him.
And he would run around and find props and cast models. It was really a huge effort just to get started on the preliminary sketches that would lead to the painting.
Exactly. And he always drew from life. He needed to have everything in front of him when he drew it. One night, I love the story where one of his sons, who was sick in bed, said, "Dad, can you draw me a clown to cheer me up?" And Rockwell said, "A clown? I can't draw a clown because I don't have a model in front of me." Of course he could have drawn a clown, but he chose not to. He was a very nervous realist. And whether he was drawing the human figure or a piano or a picture or anything, he had to have it in front of him. He needed to look at it.
My guest is author Deborah Solomon. Her new book is called American Mirror, The Life and Art of Norman Rockwell. We'll come back to our conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join it, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Deborah Solomon. Her new book is called American Mirror, The Life and Art of Norman Rockwell. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Deborah, before the break, you described Rockwell, and I think this is a great phrase, as a very nervous realist. And in fact, throughout his life, he was a rather unhappy, anxious person.
He was. He was as tortured as any artist who ever lived.
And the source of that, I mean, I suppose it's hard to say what it was, but I think people who think that they can look at Rockwell's paintings would be surprised to know he was married 3 times, divorced twice, not a great relationship with his own children.
No. No, he was a very lonely man who felt vulnerable and imperiled much of the time. Many readers have expressed surprise to me that somebody who painted such an upbeat, cheerful, Arcadian vision of America could feel so desolate himself. But I see the work as sort of an expression of his longing. He was consoled by the visions he painted, and his work also allowed him to recreate his childhood.
Recreate a childhood that didn't exist, make over the childhood he wished he had had.
Exactly. I think that's how I see his work. So I do see enormous desire in the pictures, desire for happiness, if not quite. So they're not as simple, I think, as they seemed at first.
And I suppose that's what happens to any of us when we look at most Rockwell paintings, right? They make us wish that we had experienced something as sweet and simple and self-evident as what is there before us.
Exactly. Most anyone can relate to them. If you don't recognize the people in them, you think, well, you know, that kind of reminds me of a grandmother I knew. Or we see that giant turkey on the Thanksgiving table and think, oh, yes, I had turkey once in my childhood. That seemed very large at the time, impossibly large. And so I do think that everybody can find something to relate to in his pictures.
We have an email here from Elizabeth, who has read the book and has a question just a little beyond the confines of it. She says she wants to know what happened to Rockwell's children. Elizabeth writes, his boys had a tough childhood, distant father, alcoholic mother. I'm wondering how they fared as adults.
So interesting. Other people have asked me that. I clearly should have had an epilogue about the 3 boys. He had 3 sons. They're remarkable people. They're all artistic. 2 are artists. 1 is a writer. They're about 80 years old now, 80 and up. And they were baffled and mystified and hurt by their childhood, but really, really have made lives for themselves and fairly... I think fairly sane lives for themselves. So, you know, no one became a drug addict or suffered terribly in any way that I could see. And they're still trying to make peace with their childhood, which is why I think they allowed me to go through all their papers. Of course, they helped me obtain their father's psychiatric records. I couldn't have done that without their participation. And I think it's because they are still trying to understand their own difficult childhoods and appreciate information. They're not clinging to any kind of sentimentalized version of their childhoods, that's for sure. And I felt very lucky to have their cooperation with this book.
What kind of help did Rockwell seek for himself and also for his wife, who struggled mightily?
Yeah, his second wife, Mary Rockwell, the mother of his children, was an alcoholic. And she entered treatment long before he did because of her drinking problems. But by speaking to her doctors, Rockwell learned about psychiatry. And he then decided to enter therapy himself with Erik Erikson, who was one of the great psychotherapists of the 20th century. This was at Austin Riggs, the Austin Riggs Center in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. And Rockwell and Erik Erikson became very close friends. It was more than just a patient therapist relationship. Erickson really kept Rockwell going throughout the 50s and into the 60s. And I was really glad to be able in my book to show how constructive their relationship was. I think Erickson was really the first person who made Rockwell feel supported in his life.
What evidence did you find, Deborah, that Norman Rockwell was attracted to men?
Well, let's see. Men and boys. Boyishness was certainly the main subject of his work. He painted many more boys than girls and many more men than women. And in real life, he enjoyed male company much more than female company. He often went off on fishing trips that might last a few weeks at a time with his male buddies. And he clearly savored male company and felt more comfortable with men than around women. But I didn't find any evidence of sexual contact with men. And I'm assuming that he was just one of those guys who liked to hang out with other guys.
When you talk about
some people have asked me, why didn't you call him gay? And I said, why would I call him gay? You know, I have no evidence of sexual activity with other men, but clearly his life revolved around fantasies of ruggedness and boyishness and virility. That's the world that he wanted to be part of and where he felt most at home.
There's a poignant story in the book of a teenage boy that Rockwell painted from the time the boy was, 8 or 9 years old as a subject.
Right.
That he grew pretty close to. Can you talk about that?
That was so painful to me. The boy's name was Billy Payne, and he was Rockwell's first model. And Rockwell used him almost exclusively for quite a few years. Eventually, Rockwell could no longer use Billy because Billy was too old and was no longer a young boy but a strapping teenager. And Billy Payne fell apart when Rockwell rejected him. He had to be sent off to boarding school because he had so many academic difficulties, and he was so distressed that his parents didn't really know what to do with him. And he ends up falling from a rooftop to his death. It's an incredibly tragic story, and it reminded me of how painful it could be for a model, any model who poses for an artist, to be cast aside for another model.
Sure, once you're no longer the most important subject, once you're not the most fascinating person in the world, that's got to hurt, especially for a young person.
I know. You know, we often hear about female models being cast aside, like Picasso's lovers and mistresses who committed suicide or met tragic ends after he moved on to someone else, right? Mm. But I had never thought about it in terms of a child feeling abandoned. And that was probably the most painful part of the book for me. I very carefully investigated the story of Billy Payne, and just it was heartbreaking. He clearly loved Rockwell and fell apart when Rockwell no longer wanted to paint him.
And what was Rockwell's response? I mean, there was a final work that sort of paid tribute to Billy.
I think like a lot of artists, he saved the best part of himself for his work and was not as involved with the people in his life as he might have been. So, you know, you could fault him for not being as thoughtful of other people as he could have been, but I also know we don't fault Picasso and Matisse for that, and I think that we have to grant him some license to be self-absorbed and a little bit thoughtless, as great artists tend to be.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to John in Irving. Hello, John.
Hello.
Hi, yes, John.
I wanted to ask our author, what would be the average time that he spent on a canvas for a magazine cover? Say, this average size canvas, one that goes over the fireplace.
Well, he would try to do them in 2 weeks, but some lasted much longer. And when he did, for instance, the Four Freedoms canvases, which you probably all know, to illustrate President Roosevelt's Four Freedoms, each of those took several months to complete. and he worked himself into such a state that he couldn't sleep, he couldn't eat, he would become sick until he got it right. So 2 weeks if a painting was going well, and several months if it wasn't going well.
What was the assignment process like? He worked for the Saturday Evening Post and later for Look magazine. How did he sort of talk with his editors about what he planned to do?
He would have to pitch ideas, just the way journalists pitch ideas to their editors. He would do a few rough sketches and submit his ideas, and they would say, go with this one, or please don't go with that one. And plenty were turned down.
Was there an immediate market for the full-sized canvases that he created?
No, absolutely not. As a matter of fact, even in his will, he didn't leave the work to his children because he didn't think it was valuable. He left them the copyright on his work, so the right to collect on the reproduction of his work. The reproduction rights were more valuable at the time of his death than the paintings themselves. Now, of course, the paintings are really up there in terms of prices. There's an auction coming up at Sotheby's in December in New York at which three of his well-known canvases will be put up on the block and are expected to draw at least $10 million apiece.
I did not expect to read that Andy Warhol was a genuine fan of Norman Rockwell.
Yeah, well, isn't that thrilling?
Yeah.
Andy Warhol bought a painting of Jackie Kennedy by Rockwell and another one of Santa Claus. And I thought, to Warhol, Jackie and Santa were probably the same, you know, just people known by their first name, stars. I think artists generally admired Rockwell a lot, and the criticism came from art critics and other critics. But in working on this book, one of the great surprises to me was how highly Rockwell is regarded by his fellow artists, who can appreciate his technique and the detail and the obsessiveness and the incredible realism of his portrayals of the American landscape. Yeah. So de Kooning was also a great admirer, Willem de Kooning, the great abstract expressionist painter. There are a few wonderful stories in which he expresses genuine admiration for Rockwell and would kind of pore over the reproductions of his work. And to an immigrant painter like de Kooning, Rockwell really offered a vision of America that you couldn't get anywhere else.
Will you talk a little bit about the way that Rockwell would layer paint and from a sort of technical standpoint, what made his work so amazing to people who understand how hard it is to do this well?
I know. It was such a complicated process. It's incredible. There were many, many stages to it. It began when he had an idea, and he always had trouble coming up with ideas. He thought that was the hardest part of painting, coming up with a new idea. He would lock himself in a room twice a week in the evening with pencils and paper and try to come up with ideas. But once he had the idea, that was only the beginning, because he would have to have the idea approved by his editors in Philadelphia. Then he would have to scout out models and stage a scene in much the way that a film director might. He had to collect the props. He did all of this himself. He didn't have a production team working for him, of course, and would haul whatever he needed into his studio if he was going to paint it. Once, even when he was painting blood, he wanted to see how blood looked on fabric. He asked the Red Cross to send him a tube of blood. And it arrived in a refrigerated box, temperature-controlled box. And what about, he would ask NASA to send him astronaut uniforms, astronaut suits, to his studio so he could make sure that he had every detail right on that. So he would go to great lengths to obtain the objects that he was painting. And then it got even more complicated after that, because there were many stages of drawing and doing rough paintings before he got to the final painting. Basically, he was a very nervous person who would take all these precautionary steps to keep himself from what he saw as going astray. He was very hard on himself. I think that's also a trait of most great artists. They're perfectionists. They have a vision in their head, and they're not going to stop until they get there. other people might not understand why they work so hard.
And then half a dozen times a day, he had this sort of compulsion. He'd have to tidy up his studio and sweep things down and make sure there was no dust anywhere. That had to have been, I mean, a burden to him to feel that need to keep everything so perfect.
Right. That's true. But on the other hand, he said he enjoyed cleaning up, that was how he relaxed. He liked sweeping the studio. He had a lot of obsessive compulsive tendencies. He washed his paintings with ivory soap. And in one diary from a fishing trip, on his first day in Montreal, he mentions that he had his shoes shined three times. And I thought, who else goes on a fishing trip and has his shoes shined? He, you know, wanted to avoid mud and dirt. And I think you feel some of that in the paintings, too. They're pretty sanitized.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't like dirt and dirty emotions. He really wants to clean up his life and his work.
So he wrote the story of his own life. Can you talk about what you were struck by him leaving in and leaving out?
Mm-hmm. Well, in his own autobiography, he tells a lot of amusing stories, but doesn't really talk too much about his family, his childhood, how he felt about his parents, how he felt about his work. Mostly it's amusing stories about people he met. And he's not somebody who really cares about dates that much. He doesn't care about getting them right, which is fine because he's not a reporter, so he's not obligated to get dates right, and I'm not going to hold it against him. But it left me happily with a lot of work to do. And these days it's so easy to check everything because we have newspaper archives online. We have Ancestry.com to check facts. I hear music.
Yes, we're going to take a quick break here. My guest is author Deborah Solomon. Her new book is called American Mirror, The Life and Art of Norman Rockwell. You can join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Deborah Solomon. Her new book is called American Mirror, The Life and Art of Norman Rockwell. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Deborah, we've talked a bit about Norman Rockwell's life. Let's talk about some of these works of art that people can probably call to mind without even going online to Google them, but you can find many of them online as well. Rosie the Riveter, a famous, iconic image, did a lot to sort of inspire Americans' commitment to the war and to the effort needed to win it, but had a sort of classical reference in it that people may not be aware of.
Yes, it riffs on a figure in Michelangelo's Sistine Ceiling. And she is, if you look at Rosie, very muscular. And the model for the painting actually wasn't too happy when she saw the finished work because she wondered why Rockwell had given her arms like Jack Dempsey, as she said, I think. And it's a wonderful image that pays tribute to the women who worked in factories during World War II.
I don't know that I had ever seen before your book the beautiful portrait he did of LBJ.
Mm. It's an interesting story. I have a whole chapter on it. And LBJ at first, of course, complained about posing for Rockwell and was a little bit grumpy. But later on, once another portraitist came in and did a work, LBJ decided in retrospect that he loved the painting. And today it's in Washington, right? That that portrait, I believe. No, sorry. I'm sorry. That painting is in Austin.
He gave it to LBJ. LBJ gave it to a donor, right?
Exactly. I'm pretty sure that's at the LBJ Library in Austin.
Oh, good. Well, then maybe folks around here can make the drive and check it out.
And then there were also some Rockwell paintings at Boy Scout headquarters in Irving.
Oh, sure. Sure. He did the calendars for years after he left Boys Life magazine.
Exactly. He always did the annual calendar for the Boy Scouts of America.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Cynthia in Irving. Hi, Cynthia.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about the picture of the little girl in the white dress and the tomato being thrown at her.
Ruby Bridges.
And I wondered if he pitched that picture or if it was a personal belief of his. How did he feel about that issue?
Thanks for your call.
Thanks for calling. Yeah, no, that painting was near and dear to his heart. It remains the defining image of the civil rights movement. It's the one that everyone thinks of. I think the image we all think of when we think of the desegregation of schools. And Rockwell was moved to paint it in 1964. It's incredibly moving. There's little Ruby Bridges making her way into a school where, yes, a tomato is being thrown at her, as you mentioned, and crowds are booing her. And Rockwell never met Ruby Bridges, but adored that painting and was very committed to civil rights.
Did the painting itself spark more conversations than there were news photographs of Ruby Bridges, the real Ruby Bridges, making that walk? Was there something about the painting that sort of changed the dialogue in this country?
I think so. I think that Rockwell really made you aware of her plight by the composition and brilliance of the painting. What he did was he has four marshals escorting her to school, but he's cut off the heads of the marshals. So you see their bodies, and they're all the same. And yet Ruby Bridges is a true individuated person. So what's interesting is he made the white men in the painting, the marshals, invisible, and focused the spotlight on her. And I think anybody who sees that painting has to feel for that little girl.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Jim in Fort Worth. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Several years ago, we went to the Norman Rockwell Museum. Had quite a bit of time on our hands, so did some pretty thorough walkthrough. I came across a section of the museum that had a lot of books and pamphlets for sale, and it reflected largely some political perspectives that seemed to be just about as polar opposite the public image of Norman Rockwell as I have ever could imagine. Some very radical political publications there, including anti-war material, CIA atrocities, and things that are just totally you would never think of when you think of Norman Rockwell. So I'm wondering if this was actually something that he agreed with but kept under his hat, if it's something that his estate has allowed to happen, or are they just reflecting some of his actual beliefs that maybe he never brought to the public arena?
Well, thanks for your call, Jim. We'll get an answer for you.
Okay. Well, he was very devoted to equal rights and nuclear disarmament. Those were his two big causes. But he didn't really identify too much, I think, with either party, and just celebrated a vision of equality in his work. That is the great theme in some ways of his work. It's really about the communitarian impulse in American life, where people help one another and look each other in the eye when they speak and don't have government shutdowns but are capable of working out their problems. You could see that to some degree as innate. You could see it as political or apolitical, however you want to read that. Some would say that a communal view of America is one that's basically a liberal view because it supports the welfare state and people taking care of one another. Other people might say that it's a conservative view because it shows people taking care of one another without any help from the government. So, you know, I think basically he was not partisan. His favorite president was Eisenhower. But he got along with everybody, and I prefer to say that he came to embrace democratic causes with a little D instead of a big D.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Mike is on the line now in Las Colinas. Hi, Mike.
Yes, hello, Chris. Great show again, as always.
Thank you.
Sure. My question is that I happened to meet an artist named Gerald Farm in New Mexico, and he's often considered the Norman Rockwell of the Southwest. Is there actually a wide range of artists that can be clearly shown to be influenced by Rockwell? And that's my question. I'll take my
Thanks,
answer Jericho.
Here. Mm-hmm. Tell me his name again, please.
Gerald Farm, I believe, is what he said.
Gerald Farm. I'll have to look. I think Rockwell represents the end of a tradition more than the beginning of one because photography came along during his lifetime. Life magazine came along in 1936 and overshadowed the Post and sort of pushed illustration into the past. So he was at the end of the golden age of illustration. And of course he had followers, and I'm sure there were many fine artists who have been inspired by him. But in general, illustration seems less present than it was during his lifetime.
I was thinking as I was reading the book, like how much earlier Rockwell would have had to be born to have been sort of celebrated in his lifetime, maybe by the art elite of the day. Would it have to be 200 years, 100 years?
You know, what's interesting is he really didn't have that as an ambition. Hmm. A lot of illustrators do show at galleries. They want to have shows at museums. Not Rockwell. He really called himself an illustrator, and I think he meant it. And what's interesting is that we're still looking at his work 35 years after his death. Because clearly there was more to them than just illustration. They transcended themselves and kind of threw a monkey wrench into all the classification and categories of critics because they turn out to have the staying power of any painting done during his lifetime.
Are there some, I mean, obviously, even Norman Rockwell doesn't sort of hit it out of the ballpark every time. But
no, definitely not.
Are there, can you find entire sort of years when he was really firing on all cylinders? And can you, mm-hmm. knowing now the dates of when his life was better and worse, relatively speaking, on a personal level, can you see that reflected in his work at all?
Is there a connection, that's interesting, between his personal contentment and the quality of his work?
Mm-hmm. Or discontentment.
Or discontent that matters. And the quality of his work. I don't see that much of a connection. I mean, the Four Freedoms, for instance, were, I think he was always kind of coming from the same place. Whether he felt, I can't think of a really happy time in his life, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. I don't know what that would be. I think he always created out of a real desire for happiness. And I'm not sure he ever felt very fulfilled.
It seems like he was aware of the image that America wanted for him and tried to deliver that up when he was interviewed or when he wrote his autobiography. How invested do you feel like he was in his image, which may or may not have reflected reality for him?
He was very invested in his image and wanted to be a folk hero who the type of man who was very easygoing and could always tell a joke and made light of everything and who kept his private life hidden. Hmm.
Do you think Rockwell knew why he wasn't happy? Would he have been able to put his finger on it?
Well, I'm not a shrink, and I'm much more comfortable analyzing the work than the man. I mean, we can look at the man and look at the information we have, but in terms of figuring out his motives and what he knew about himself, you can never say. I assume he knew he was very familiar with his own discontent and the source of it because he was very smart and very perceptive. But, you know, that's something we can never know for sure.
So there are a number of beautiful color plates included in the book, but I also know that this sort of thing is expensive, right, to get the rights and to reproduce things in color. Can you talk about how you made the decisions about the images that you really wanted to include and whether there were any that you lost sleep over?
Well, when I'm writing about art, I feel like it's important for readers to be able to look at a reproduction next to the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like if a discussion of art goes on for more than two or three sentences, you have to have the reproduction there or people are going to lose interest. And it was very important to me to insert black and white reproductions of the paintings I discuss at length into the text. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the color reproductions, I did reproduce some of my favorites, but all the permission comes from one source. Are you aware of that?
Is it
the owner of the painting?
Right.
The owner of the painting
doesn't own the image. Yes.
Does not own the copyright. So it doesn't matter who owns the painting. The right to reproduce the painting comes from his children.
Right. Right.
And I was very lucky that they gave me permission to reproduce everything at almost no cost. So I'm incredibly grateful for that. The book would have really been diminished if I didn't have all those pictures in it.
Rockwell's paintings were created to be reproduced, and they have, you know, it's been done beautifully over the years in a variety of ways and places. What do you see and notice when you are in person looking at a particular work that even the best reproduction can't give us?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you know, I love the reproductions. I think they were made to be reproduced, and I don't think you're missing a lot when you see them in reproduction. When you see them in person, you mostly note the scale. They're much larger than the magazine covers, and you see some brushstroke. You can see visible brushstrokes, but he wasn't a painter who wanted to show off juicy brushstrokes like Monet and the Impressionists.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think looking at his work in a book is pretty satisfying.
The new book by art and culture writer Deborah Solomon is called American Mirror, The Life and Art of Norman Rockwell. She joined us from the studios of NPR. Deborah, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, Chris, and happy Thanksgiving.
You too. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Christine McConnell prepares our podcast. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.